This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore, and happy Valentine's Day, everyone. We have a quick supplemental that is, well, sentimental.
Yeah, you've always been the sensitive one, Zach.
What is that supposed to mean?
I don't know. It is what it is.
This Valentine's Day, we're going to discuss the best Kirk romances from the original series, and there are quite a few, aren't there, Ken?
Yeah, I like this idea. And you know, I think from the reboots, you know, you got this impression that Kirk was really a big-time player. But when you came up with this, and I give you full credit, you came up with this, and you look back, you know, there wasn't a ton of romances. And I thought it was very appropriate, seeing that it is Valentine's Day, to kind of go back and take a look at the favorites.
Ooh, yeah, love music. They always play like, ooh. I might drop that in post. We'll see, you guys. We'll see if I took the time to do that. But that's what I always think of when I think of these montages, because I remember it might have been like the 25th anniversary special or one of these Star Trek specials where they have they play that music and they just showed all the Kirk kisses and stuff from the show, and that always stuck with me, that video montage of all the many loves of Kirk.
Yeah, he did kiss a lot, didn't he?
He did, and you're right, there is a perception that Kirk was a womanizer, and yes, he did have a lot of forays into relations with the opposite sex on the original series, but it's not like he wasn't, you know, sleeping with the green alien girl every week. Like, that's the cliche, and that is so rare, right? I mean, yeah. Yes, compared to the other captains, yes, he probably did more romancing than the rest of them, but you know, it was, you know, he's a good looking guy in his 30s, man, you know. I can relate. So, well, not yet. I'm 29. So, so you're doing what you do. But anyway,
I wish I could remember that far back. But you know, what's funny too is if you haven't seen it, have you seen the robot chicken episode with Kirk and having to go back and tell all these girls that he gave them some kind of space herpes? Oh my god!
Oh, no, I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah, if listeners, if you haven't seen it and you kind of have a, you know, that sense of humor that I have that can go the other direction sometimes, it is pretty damn funny.
That is such a robot chicken thing to do. I love how they take those things and just play them to the absurd extreme on that show. That's great. Oh man! So Ken, what is your favorite romance of Captain Kirk?
As I thought about it and was going back and forth, I thought the best romance was the one he had in Paradise Syndrome with Miramani. I liked it for a couple of reasons. One, it was, you know, it was an interesting circumstance. Obviously, Kirk loses his memory, becomes Kirok.
I am Kirok.
And he falls in love. He actually gets married. They're going to have a baby. I mean, it went about as far as we'd seen any romance goes. And it was tragic ending, you know. And it wasn't an ending where it all just kind of comes together in a nice little bow. It was actually pretty sad. And, you know, and it was real. So that's you know, there's a lot of them out there, and I'm sure as we get talking into yours, we can talk about others. But I, you know, after kind of going through it, I thought that was the one that was probably the most intense.
You know, that episode takes place over, what, 2 months or longer, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, along that timeline, yeah.
So that really does help that particular romance because there's time for you to be like, oh, well, they got to know each other, they fell in love, they spent some actual time together because, you know, being an episodic television show, the original series, it's we're in, we're out, 50 minutes onto the next journey. You don't really delve into characters. There's the time span is very truncated, right? So these romances of the week, they come and they go, and they don't feel like they have a lot of weight to them. Wow, in this situation, totally. I totally see what you're saying about Miramani there. And the Paradise Syndrome, it's an interesting episode. It had some pretty interesting concepts. For season three, I'd say that's one of the better episodes, mainly for the emotional aspect to it, Ken.
Yeah, you know, we joke about the bonk bonk on the head, which is how he loses his memory.
Exactly. Right.
But, and that's become kind of a tired play, I guess, or a tired trope that you see on TV a lot, and they just remember just enough to function, but nothing else. But, you know, it is what it is. It was fun. It was a very different episode. Again, they take risks on Star Trek. They took risks with that. You know, I'm sure they weren't sure how that was going to play, but it worked out.
So, Kim, my only kind of thing about the Paradise Syndrome is it's not really Kirk. I mean, because he has amnesia, does that bother you at all? That's not really him? Or is it more like, you see it as more like he's free now of all his responsibility, and that's why it's such a... he's able to go headlong in that relationship the way he did.
That's right. It's the latter part of that, Zach. Great question. And I could see how you could take that either way, right? But he's not tied down to a ship. He's not tied down to anything. And he's free. I mean, he could look at her and go, eh. Or, you know, he could find that right woman. But he's got to live his life. And, of course, I mean, he's trying to figure things out as he goes. But I thought the reason why, to me, it made the most sense was because it was the most pure, right? There was... The reason he was there was one thing, but he didn't know what it was, right? Or any piece of it. In every other case, he was either on some kind of mission or, you know, there was something going on that forced him into the situation. And there just happened to be this right woman there, and it took the story where it went with those. But this one, that's what made it different for me, was this was 100% pure choice. And from watching that episode, probably been about a year and a half, maybe two, since I've seen it. But I just remember going, you know, this is kind of a neat thing for Kirk. And it, he was free and clear to do whatever he wanted. He chose her. He's going to marry her. You know, kind of a mini Inner Light story. I don't know. But I what I liked about it.
I like that. The original series, Inner Light. There you go.
Yeah, sort of, kind of. But there are things that that tie the two series together, I think, very well. That, you know, that there's some concepts that really came across in TOS that were used in TNG. But in this case, yeah, it was that. It was just that it was pure.
Interesting. You know, I haven't watched that episode in a while, but I'm going to rewatch it with that frame of mind, the whole original series take on Inner Light, if you will. I like that. So I'll keep that in mind next time I watch The Paradise Syndrome, Ken.
Good, good, good. Glad you will. That's where I'm at, Zach. So what about you, sir?
So for me, I'm going to go cliche. I'm going to say City on the Edge of Forever, Edith Keeler. I know that's that's probably the cliche answer, but I think it's cliche for a reason. I mean, everybody gravitates towards that as the epic romance of Kirk and Edith Keeler. And the way I see it, you know, I'm a big fan of the Crucible trilogy of novels that came out for the 40th anniversary. And that takes the City on the Edge of Forever, and each book focuses on Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. It's a trilogy of books, and it just focuses in on that story and extrapolates around it, past and future, and how the events of that episode echo throughout their lives. And that took the approach that they were actually in the past for an extended period of time. So much like Paradise Syndrome, Ken, where Kirk was on that planet for a couple of months, you know, the same can be said for Kirk and Spock when they were in New York in the 30s, like, because they didn't just show up, and then, of course, in the episode, it kind of seems that way. It's like they show up, and then McCoy just shows up. But, you know, there's a passage of time. If you look, Kirk and Spock rent an apartment, look like they've been doing their thing there for a while. So there is a true amount of time for Kirk and Edith Keeler to get to know each other and to fall in love. And it's very innocent, really flirtatious love, and that's what's great about it. And it's Kirk finds love where he least expects it, right? They're there to go find McCoy and reset the timeline. But little do they know, he'd find a kindred spirit, right, in Edith Keeler, who sees beyond her time and is very idealistic. And, you know, you can see why that would connect to somebody like Kirk, because, I mean, look at the Paradise Syndrome, right? At the beginning of that episode, he's talking about how, you know, a simpler life would be nice and all that. And so, you know, he really gravitates towards people with idealism, which, I mean, he himself is an idealist as well. I mean, I don't think every Starfleet captain can quote the Constitution of the United States, you know, from memory. So the man is an idealist. So, you know, I just really like William Shatner and Joan Collins' chemistry there. And you really do buy, even though we only, like I said, episodic TV, 50 minutes, you're in and out. But over that 50 minutes, you really feel the chemistry there, and you really feel the emotional weight of the end of the episode where he has to let her die to preserve the timeline. And that is hardcore. And you can even see it, just how he's devastated, right? In that last shot in the 30s where he can't even bear to look. And then, of course, when they get back to the planet and he says, let's get the hell out of here. Like, whoa, that really affected him, right? So, you know, for all the reasons, I mean, people talk about Sydney on the Edge of Forever all day long. And it's, you know, arguably Trek's, well, it's definitely its most famous episode. It's arguably its best. And I really do feel that Edith Keeler is the best love interest that Kirk had on the original show.
Yeah, you can't argue your choice. I think that's an excellent choice. And it's up there. You know, when I was going through it, obviously, I think that was the first one I thought about. And then I kind of did a review of the different episodes and I went, oh, yeah. And then, you know, that's the only reason it switched for me, was just kind of, you know, and it is... I guess there is kind of a danger to falling in love with James T. Kirk. you know, maybe they should wear red. I don't know. Because good things do not happen to these ladies. But, yeah, obviously, City on the Edge of Forever and Edith Keeler, such a powerful episode, such an emotional episode, the whole nine yards. And it was a brilliant story with a captivating love interest, you know, and it was born too, not to, you know, Joan Collins, don't get me wrong, she's a very attractive lady, but, you know, here's a woman who's dressed in the garb of the late 1930s, early 1940s, very conservative, and really is appreciated for her heart, her charitable works, her mindset, her glowing, you know, appeal towards the future. You know, a lot of things that were attractive to Kirk beyond what you would see in a lot of the other episodes, which were, you know, women that were scantily dressed or, you know, made up, blonde, over the top sometimes. And, you know, that aspect of it is something that to be admired in that relationship, because it goes against what they did with him a lot of times as other shows came around. And, you know, it showed that he was more than a surface guy. Let's put it that way.
Right. There's a definite maturity to that relationship. They connect on a mental level, you know, more than just the superficial stuff. And, you know, because there will always be episodes where, like, an attractive woman comes by and, like, you know, Kirk and Bones share a look and, you know, something like that. And that's not the case here, you know. And that's an excellent point there, Ken. You know, they connect. Their souls connect, right? It's not just a physical attraction, which, of course, they're both good-looking people. But it goes beyond that. And you know, that's just something. Not that you're ever going to find yourself in that situation, right? But you got to think, like, man, if I was in that situation, what would I do? Would I really let her die like that? Like, that's tough. Like, I don't know. What would you do, Ken, if you're in that situation?
Oh, good God, who knows? I mean, you know, the heart can be a very powerful instrument in things like that. And, you know, obviously, you're talking about your interest in your own life, and the deaths of millions more than, you know, than the 23 or 24 million people that died during World War II. So, yeah, I would make the right decision to get the timeline right, because I wasn't supposed to be here in the first place. But, yeah, at that split second, who knows, you know, how you'd react.
Well, it's even worse that it's like, he's going to move and he stops himself, but then he has to stop McCoy from doing it too. So it's like a double, like you have to stop yourself and stop someone else from saving the life of the woman you love. Like that is heavy stuff, man.
So. Yeah. Do you know what you've done? He knows, doctor. He knows. It was rough.
So happy Valentine's Day, huh? Yeah. Yeah, you're right, Ken. It is not safe to have a long-term romantic relationship with James T. Kirk. If you just have a fling with him, you might be okay. You know,
yeah, but well, you know, you had Carol Marcus and she did all right, right?
Right. She would probably be my number two just for the fact that Kirk had a son with Carol Marcus and they had a, you know, again, that's more of an intellectual relationship. She is a completely self-made woman, respected scientist, you know, she's doing her thing, Kirk's doing his thing. And they don't even do some cheesy thing where they kind of like they see each other again for the first time in years and they rekindle some romance. You can tell there's still an affection there, but they understand it like, you know, that was then, this is now, and there's a maturity to their relationship even well past the romance.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes that special, and the fact that, you know, she wanted to be the influence of their son and not really have him involved or tied in, which, you know, to me, that was kind of a sad moment, you know, when that was said and spoken. And, you know, you would hope that Kirk would, I guess, be a better father. It just kind of an odd thing. But that doesn't have much to do with the relationship with Carol Marcus, right? What attracted to her. I mean, as we saw in the reboot, she was a very attractive woman, but she was also a very intelligent woman. And those two things are never mutually exclusive, I think. You know, you can be attractive to someone like he was to Edith Keeler because of who she is, not what she looks like. And it was probably a mix like that for Carol Marcus. I thought one other interesting relationship was with Raina Caper from Requiem for Methuselah.
Yeah, see, that is an underrated episode, Requiem for Methuselah. Now, I believe Vic Mignogna, I believe that's his favorite episode from Star Trek Continues, who plays Kirk and pretty much is the head guy over there at Star Trek Continues. I believe that's his favorite episode of Star Trek. I believe I read an interview like that. And that's a very fascinating choice. The only thing I would say about that, though, is it's so rushed, that whole romance, right? It just takes over just a couple days, right? And he's, like, devastatedly in love with her. Like, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, as I thought about that, a couple things entered my head. One, you know, she was perfectly constructed, right? She obviously was, I don't know if she was considered an android. I don't remember, but she was definitely synthetic. And
she was a replicant. No.
Yeah, replicant. That's the right word. And she was, you know, she was created by a genius. So I looked at it, now that I look at it, I think about how Riker fell for Minuet, you know, the perfect woman, you know, and that's what he saw.
That's a good call, yeah.
Yeah, and it was such a powerful draw for him. And, you know, obviously, again, another tragic ending, right? She kind of short circuits. And he needs his mind wiped by Spock because of how powerful that love was, right? That was also very interesting. Whereas, you know, not Edith Keeler, not Miramani, not Carol Marcus or whatever, was it so devastated that, you know, he needed help from his friend to help, you know, alleviate the pain. And that to me was kind of, wow, you know, that's, you know, that must have been some kind of torrid love affair.
Well,
you know,
a couple things on that point.
The feelings just ran so deep, yeah.
Like, that is the genesis for the Remember in Star Trek II. Is
that's
the
right.
Forget in Requiem for Methuselah. You know, that's you can see how that ties together there. Remember, forget. I like that.
That's a great point. I hadn't put that together, yeah.
And I don't know if that was intentional or not, but that's the way I choose to see it. And
I doubt it was intentional, but it's, you know, I don't think Nick Meyer was going, oh, let's do this. But anyway.
I don't know. Harv Bennett sat down and he watched all 79 episodes, so goes the story. So he might have made a note of that. Who knows? But
maybe.
The other thing is, you know, I actually edited a version of just for my own purposes. The end of Sydney on the Edge of Forever, and I added this scene, I edited around it, because I feel like this scene at the end of Requiem for Methuselah fits better at the end on Sydney on the Edge of Forever, right? So I made this little, like, fan-edit scene, and you have to cut around some certain things, and so I uploaded it on live, and then it was taken down for copyright reasons, so hey-oh, but...
Whoopsie.
So if you want to see what I did there, just contact me personally, maybe we can work something out, but... but, it's an excellent scene in a good episode, and that whole emotional thread elevates what, you know, it just carries you over the plot inconsistencies where you're like, I don't know. It's only been a day, but you make an excellent point about, you know, Flint creating the perfect woman there, Ken, and why she'd be so attractive to Kirk in such a short amount of time. So, yeah, that ending alone, just for Spock and McCoy, their back and forth about love, is very powerful. And then, of course, you know, Spock proves McCoy wrong by showing he has the love of friendship for Kirk, for seeing how much he's hurting, to erase that memory. Now, if that's the right thing to do, who's to say? It's a pretty intrusive thing to do without someone's consent. But hey, what are you gonna do?
Yeah. Not to bring up Star Trek V, but I you know, I need my pain. Should I turn left when I turn right?
It's like, actually, you know, Jim, let me tell you about this time that I.
Yeah. Well, let me give this back to you and see if you still want it. It's just an interesting premise. Obviously, his number one romance is with his ship. There's no doubt about that.
There you go. I knew you were going to pull that. You're your favorite character of the Enterprise, right, Ken? I knew you were going to pull that one out.
Yeah, and it's something that I can certainly relate to. You do tend to have this affinity and affection for anything that you become a part of. And I can't imagine, like you said, you know, just like you, extremely attractive, in his 30s, you know, all that other stuff.
I'm 29, for the record.
Is that all you are?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh my God. But at any rate, I think of that one element. I mean, you don't meet a lot of ship's captains usually that young. Now, years ago, that was very common. And, you know, in World War II, ship's captains were in their, you know, late 20s, early 30s, some of them. They might not have the rank of captain, lieutenant commanders or whatever, but they captain ships. That's pretty romantic in itself. I mean, you've got this incredible vessel too. I mean, that there's got to be a lot of appeal to having that kind of, authority and status in the Federation, right? There's only 12 of those type of ships, so it's two things. You know, he's got this beautiful, majestic ship that, you know, for all intents and purposes, is one of, if not the flagship of the Federation. He's in command of it, and it serves them extraordinarily well. It takes a pounding, but it gives it right back. And then, you know, you have himself as this very, very powerful individual who plays it right. And I think it's kind of neat that they played it that way, because a lot of ship's captains do think of their vessels along those ways. And you know, I remember many, many years ago, you know, you could be stationed on some rust buckets out there. But they'll always tell you, you know, never put down your command, never put down your ship, no matter how old it is, no matter how rough a shape it, never put it down, because it's you and the team that's going to, you know, make it so that she can fight and that she can get you home.
And she also comes to a tragic end, huh, Ken?
She does. And his emotion during that tragic end tells you how much he cared for it.
Yeah.
You know, just like, in Star Trek, the motion picture. I mean, that whole scene where he's just staring at it and just, you know, it's like, I'm back and you're more beautiful than ever, right?
That's good. Well, that's a good callback about the ship, because that's the, you know, I've already got a woman to worry about. Her name's the Enterprise, right? That was Kirk's deal in the original show. And that's what people forget about. Like, his first love really is the ship, like his love for duty, his love for his command, you know, and that's what overrides anything else, any kind of, you know, frivolous romantic interest. Because when he gets in these real in-depth relationships, it's extraneous circumstances, right? He's lost his memory. He's stranded on a planet. He doesn't even know he's himself.
Right.
When he's Kirok, when he's with Edith Keeler, they're in the past. They don't know how long they have back there. They're just making things go. He's free of all responsibilities in both those cases. You know?
That's right.
His command of the ship. And then, of course, you know, in Requiem from Thusla, as we talked about in some details, so the perfect woman. And then, of course, they do have that fever going on. I think it's Rigelian fever, is it? So maybe that's at play there as well.
Could be.
But for all these other, you know, these montage of women that we were talking about earlier that he gets throughout the show, there's always just something else going on. But I think we've made some good choices here, Ken, about, you know, what the highlights of Kirk's love life. And then one final bit of trivia question for you, though. Do you think the blonde lab technician from Where No Man Has Gone Before was Carol Marcus? What do you think?
No. No, I don't.
You don't like that universe shrinking?
No. No. That you know, I've heard that a few times, but you know, I'm one of those guys too, Zach. I mean, I'm probably the wrong guy to ask, because unless they spell it out, I usually don't, you know, go nuts. And I would have those conversations back when Jeff Norman and I were doing the show. You know, Jeff was a brilliant person who would tie all these things together. In fact, he has a whole website dedicated to it, right? Where, you know, one piece goes to the next and this, and then he would read all the novels and try to piece all these things together. He's that guy, right? I'm so damn pragmatic. I mean, I'm almost boring, and I know I'm not a creative guy. But, you know, when people go, well, why did he do that? I'm the guy going, because the writers wrote it that way. You know, I mean, I don't think of it beyond that. And it's in some cases, which is good and bad. But it's an interesting premise. I guess it would be fun. Has there ever been a book to tie it to that?
I'm sure there has. But I think we all know that the blonde lab technician was really Ruth from Shore Leave. I think that's who it was.
Oh, that's right. She did come back as that yeoman. And
I don't know. I'm just saying.
But there was a Star Trek Continues episode that had Carol Marcus in it. And
there was a Phase 2 episode that Star Trek New Voyages Phase 2 fan series with Carol Marcus.
That's right. You know, that was actually pretty well done, I thought.
Well, I'm not sure how exactly it fit into the continuity, because if it's supposed to take place in the, you know, fourth or fifth season of the original series, right? And that's when Kirk and Carol Marcus first meet. Do the math. David is what, like 13 in the Wrath of Khan? That's not right.
Yeah,
so
13 or 14, yeah. And maybe
I'm just saying, no, he's like 25 in the Wrath of Khan, right?
Okay, fair enough. I mean, fair enough.
So that serious continuity gap there. Now, if we're talking fan series, there actually was an episode of Star Trek Continues called The White Iris.
I remember that.
And it actually talks about how, you know, we've been, you know, referencing how all these women come to tragic ends. That episode actually addresses that in quite head on, actually, with a lot of these characters. In fact, most of the characters we've discussed here in this conversation make appearances in that episode. And Kirk has to deal with, this guilt that he feels for having lost all these previous loves in his life. So it's an interesting take. It's not something I feel like they would have done in the 60s. I think Star Trek Continues best episodes are the ones that kind of, like, you know, Leilani, for example, that's a standalone that could have actually been a fourth season episode. Would they have ever done an episode like The White Iris in 1970 on the original series? Probably not. But it's a story that they definitely had a lot of heart to it.
Sure.
So yes, the fan series delve into these relationships as well. It's just part of the fandom, right? Part of the fandom.
Hey, it's what makes it fun. And I know when I was much younger, I would always try to tie things together and make it all sensical. And you know, the more I look back and I think about how particularly the movies were made and how more and more things were updated, you know, it became more about, is this a great story to tell versus how does it fit in the entire story? And sometimes it can be a struggle to put it all together. But it's a good point about The White Iris, though. That, you know, I forgot about that episode. That boy, you're right. That does hit it right on. And sorry for mixing up the two series, Mr. Colley, Mr. Montaigne. Sorry.
Well, talking about the loves of Kirk isn't the only thing we'll be doing this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. To the journey!
The origin of the Voth was that the lizard babies went back in time.
And then they evolved into
yes.
the Voth.
Yes. Yes.
So Captain Janeway is the ancestor of their entire
yes.
race? Is that what you're saying?
Tom and Janeway are the ancestors of the entire Voth race.
Literary Treks.
It never stops. You never really have a moment to say, like, yay, good job. It's like literally, okay, on to the next thing. You're probably already late on the next three things that you're supposed to be doing.
Melodic Treks.
You know, when you're used to recording either at Abbey Road or Sony Studios in Hollywood, it's hard to go to another room that doesn't have that same kind of sound, you know. And also the depth of players is not, you know, just not as deep as it is here in London, for instance, you know.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at Trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and helps us increase our visibility for new listeners.
If you would like to get in touch with us here at Trek.fm, you can always find us on Trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter @trekfm, facebook.com/trekfm, and the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
So let me talk to you for a second about Patreon, Zach. Patreon is the program that Trek FM employs in order to get donations to keep the network coming to you commercial free. It is wonderful. Most of the hosts here on Trek FM are big contributors to Patreon and found our way onto the network through Patreon. So if you can spare any money, and we don't care what the denomination is, it really means a lot to us because there is a lot of content that we're putting up there, a lot of bandwidth, a lot of programming, a lot of equipment that we need. So please, if you can help us out, we'd appreciate it. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and you can click any donation you want. And we do have some incentives for you. So for $15 a month, you get to join the Patrons Roundtable, where you podcast. And you know, again, that is where a lot of us started. It was on the Roundtable. I was on the very first one. I had a blast. And if you can contribute $25 or more per month, then you get associate producer credits for whatever show you like. And we love our associate producers. So please, 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 if you have the ability, it is more than appreciated. And speaking of our associate producers, thank you from the bottom of our hearts to Renee Roberts, Aaron Harvey, Nicholas Anastasio, and of course, Norman Lau. Thank you all for your support of Standard Orbit and Trek FM through Patreon. Now you can find Renee at Twitter at @Emrys_1701. You can find our buddy Aaron Harvey at GeekFilter. You can find Norman Lau at Starfighter1701, and you can interact with Nick and all of us on the Babel Conference, and that's where we find Nick hanging out all the time. Yeah, and you can find me on the Babel Conference. I love to hang out there, and you can reach me through Facebook directly or via Twitter. My handle is @BostonSCPO. That stands for Senior Chief Petty Officer.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter @MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show from the early 2000s. And we're on Twitter @AlwaysMallville with one S. And also, I'm around the Babel Conference as well. It's always great to talk to you guys on there, making conversation about our shows, other shows, general Star Trek topics, anything really on there. So thanks for listening, everyone. And join us again next time here on Trek.fm for another episode of Standard Orbit.